Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, health in the news, and a variety of topics. And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. This pre-recorded program focuses on one of the most important public health issues of our time, metabolic syndrome. Like that old Saturday Night Live character used to say, it's always something. Clear away infectious disease, and up goes heart attack and stroke. Get those under control, and everyone lives to get cancer or diabetes or both, or so it seems. Some doctors raise objections to the concept of metabolic syndrome itself, saying that it's not a disease, but a constellation of risk factors. This viewpoint betrays these doctors' worldview, that there are only two states, health and disease. The reality is much more complex, in my opinion. I think it is more useful to think in terms of what in chaos mathematics are called attractors. For those who are interested, I highly recommend James Gleick's book Chaos for a clear and readable explanation of attractors, fractals, and chaos mathematics. Metabolic syndrome is a bad attractor. In physiological terms, it's as if a toxin has entered and contaminated the physiology. Certain components of the internal ecosystem die back partially, and others increase. New feedback loops emerge and self-perpetuate, and some of these amplify themselves like a positive feedback loop or recursion in a computer program and clog up the whole system. As the system becomes less efficient and optimized, parts get overloaded and fail. Now you have a disease and a host of pharmaceuticals to treat it. Wouldn't it be nice to recognize a system headed for failure before it collapses into an irreversible disease state and change these inputs early, possibly averting the whole problem? That's the value of this concept of metabolic syndrome. It gives us some easy, measurable markers that, when they occur together, indicate that the feedback loops are shifting in a direction that will lead to a disease eventually. So let's get down to specifics about metabolic syndrome. The interview you're about to hear was recorded in 2004 at the Institute for Functional Medicine conference. I like the Institute for Functional Medicine and try to attend their conferences every year because they are so far ahead of the curve and so scientific in their presentations. They really are out there reading the biochemical and nutritional literature, which, as a physician, I simply don't have time to do. Many of their ideas do eventually filter down, and hence this discussion of metabolic syndrome, which has been argued back and forth in the subsequent years along the lines I just described. A recent research article by Castorini's group was published in the Journal of American College of Cardiology this year. It talked about Mediterranean diet and metabolic syndrome. The Mediterranean diet is a diet high in monounsaturated fatty acids like olive oil, fruits, vegetables, whole grain cereal products, and low-fat dairy products, with fish, poultry, nuts, and beans or legumes. Another key to the Mediterranean diet is low consumption of red meat. Now, there's red meat and there's red meat in the United States, with the cheaper red meat being essentially adulterated with antibiotics and hormones. This is in distinction to the meat available in Europe, where most of the original studies on Mediterranean diet were done. If anything, that will amplify the adverse effect of red meat, since antibiotic and hormone levels are lower in European beef. Castorini's group specializes in meta-analysis. This sort of research pools other studies and seeks to amplify the value of the data. It's a tricky business, since which studies you select to include often determines the outcome of the meta-analysis. That being said, their methodology is pretty good, and I think we can look at their conclusions as useful. In a previous study, they had shown that following the Mediterranean diet over time was associated with decreased rates of heart disease and cancer. In this latest study, they looked at the effects of the Mediterranean diet on some of the basic metrics that we use to define the metabolic syndrome. What they showed was that adherence to the Mediterranean diet led to a decrease in waist circumference, an increase in HDL or good cholesterol, a decrease in triglyceride levels, and a decrease in systolic blood pressure. And yes, of course, blood glucose levels also dropped. But that is hardly unexpected, since metabolic syndrome can be thought of, really, as pre-diabetes. As you listen to this program, think about the changes that you could make in your diet. And listen for that, I think they're talking about me feeling, that you'll get as Dr. Bland talks about the metabolic syndrome. Thank you for your attention, and I hope you enjoy the interview. In May of 2004, I attended the 11th Annual Institute for Functional Medicine Conference. Some of these ideas will be familiar to you, as they are already part of alternative medicine, naturopathic medicine, and health food store lore. Regardless of the source of the idea, open-minded scientists, and these two terms should be synonymous, require data before accepting an item into clinical practice. Beyond critical thinking and a willingness to look at alternative medicine, other features of the paradigm shift being suggested by IFM include a reframing of medicine to see the whole person as the issue rather than a single diseased organ system. This whole person approach expands to include the environment, diet, and behavior as important factors in disease management. Another very critical concept from IFM is the emphasis on genetics. Every patient represents a unique combination of genes. Current medical practice treats the average 70-kilogram male. IFM seeks to bridge the gap between the great deal we know about treating the middle of the bell curve and help physicians treat patients on the edges of the so-called normal distribution. The ideas you are about to hear have sufficient scientific support, in my opinion, to justify adopting them. The topic of this IFM conference is diabetes and metabolic syndrome. In just a few minutes, you'll be hearing from the founder of IFM, Dr. Jeffrey Bland, and I know you'll enjoy it. But let's take a few moments, first of all, to explore the topic. Diabetes is a term that we're all familiar with. It relates to high blood sugar, caused by either a lack of insulin or caused by a lack of response to above normal levels of insulin. Really, we should be thinking about two diseases, and the diabetes that we'll be referring to in this conference is the second variety. Metabolic syndrome is a term that began to be used in the late 1980s to describe a combination of blood tests and physiological manifestations that seem to group together. If you're unfamiliar with this term, let me explain that 40% of United States adults over the age of 40 meet the criteria for this dangerous condition. It's been linked with heart attack, stroke, Alzheimer's disease, cancer, and just about everything else that keeps you awake at night worrying about your health. It is, in essence, accelerated aging. All the diseases we think of as old age diseases hit sooner and harder if you have the metabolic syndrome. The criteria for metabolic syndrome are a little bit like a menu at a Chinese restaurant. Any three of the following will do. Number one, a waistline at the belly button greater than 40 inches for a male or 35 inches for a female. Because people come in different shapes and sizes, I tend to use the gut-to-butt ratio as being more accurate. So the waistline measurement at the belly button is your gut number. The butt is the widest part of the hip circumference. In males, a gut-to-butt greater than 1 represents metabolic syndrome. In females, a number greater than 0.8 gets you a 1+ on that score. The second criteria is a blood pressure of greater than 130 over 85. The third is a fasting glucose above 110. The fourth is a triglyceride above 150. And the fifth is an HDL, the so-called good cholesterol, being less than 40 for a male and less than 50 for a female. The reason these criteria were chosen is that they are readily available to all patients and physicians. There are many other criteria that would allow for a diagnosis of metabolic syndrome, and it's important to remember that if you have a waistline of 38 and a half, a blood pressure of 129 over 84, a fasting blood glucose of 109, and a triglyceride of 149, you've got metabolic syndrome, even though you don't have, strictly speaking, the criteria met. Metabolic syndrome means, physiologically, that the complex dance between your environment and your DNA is going wrong. The consequences of this include a high level of inflammatory mediators in your body, which will rapidly lead to the development of these degenerative diseases. When I say rapidly in this context, I'm talking about a 10 to 20 year timeline. Geriatric experts assure us that if we had the keys to a healthy lifestyle and suffered no bad luck incidents like car accidents, our genes would allow for us to live till about the age of 120, give or take 10 years. The reason that the lifespan of humans rarely extends above 90 years is because we don't do all of the right things. Now, I'd love to tell you what all of the right things are, but those have yet to be determined. What I'm going to try to share with you today are some of the right things that have been scientifically validated and are very clear that you can start doing today to modify your life and, presumably, your life expectancy, whether you have metabolic syndrome or not. We're here with the founder and chairman of the Institute of Functional Medicine, Dr. Jeffrey Bland. Thank you very much for agreeing to join us.
Oh, my great pleasure. Thank you.
You said something very intriguing during your initial presentation here at the annual Institute of Functional Medicine conference. You said food is information. That seems a rather odd statement, I think. Could you elaborate on it a bit for us?
I think our belief as individuals is food is basically something that prevents either nutritional deficiency or provides enjoyment, satiety or appetite control. And that's been the dominant theme, really, in nutrition and medicine for the last 100 years, since the calorie content of foods were first discovered at the turn of the 19th going into the 20th century. But as we moved from the turn of the 20th going into the 21st century, a pretty remarkable discovery was made in the science of nutrition, and that is that there are nutrients present in our food that includes the protein, carbohydrate, and fat fractions, as well as various minerals and vitamins and other constituents of foods that actually help our book of life, which is our human genome, our chromosomes that make up who we are, help to read that book and read it in a way that expresses the message in how we look, feel, and act. Therefore, food really has information molecules in it that create then a sense of how our book of life or our experience of living will be read. And this is a very remarkable breakthrough in the understanding of how nutrition plays a role in health.
If I understand correctly, you're saying that when I eat, let's say, a complex food like, oh, I go out for an Italian meal and have lasagna and salad with balsamic vinegar, I'm getting hungry. Anyway, along with the calories and the protein and the grams of carbohydrate, I'm also reprogramming my DNA to behave differently, like olive oil?
That's a very, very good example that you use. Let's take the sauce. It may be tomato-based if it's a southern Italian cuisine. And that tomato base has a substance in it called lycopene, which is a natural product that's found in tomatoes. Lycopene has been found recently to regulate the expression of certain kinds of genes that are related to inflammation and related to insulin sensitivity. So what has been found is that there are specific nutrients that are present in that meal that you selected, which is tasty and enjoyable, which in the form it's delivered to your body actually can regulate how the genes in various organs, cells, and tissues of your body are being expressed. In other words, how they ultimately function.
Wow, that really makes the phrase "you are what you eat" take on a new connotation.
That's exactly right, and that's actually one of the most interesting parts of this, because in the past we talked about the fact that our body is constructed of the materials that we eat, so we are what we eat, and that was a kind of a gross description. Now we're getting into a much more specific description of saying there are individual substances within specific foods that can speak to our bodies in either a way to create a blissful outcome, I call it expressing your bliss genes, or can express your anger, hostility, or alarm genes, which we call inflammation. So we could select to eat a diet that had information molecules in it that enhanced our inflammation, or we could eat a diet that cooled off our inflammation and created quiescent cells and a more friendly physiology that's less at risk to heart disease or cancer or diabetes.
Also, the lycopene example is a good one because I think, if I understand this correctly, raw tomatoes don't have nearly the amount of available lycopene that a cooked tomato does. And that brings up the issue that how a food is prepared can free these beneficial compounds or, in fact, create adverse compounds, which brings us to what you were calling the advanced glycosylated end products. Let's just call that a sugar stuck onto a protein that changes the action of the protein. Talk about that concept a little bit. I found it quite fascinating, and I don't know, I may have to put my grill away.
Well, I think, again, very astute for picking this up, because I think that there are foods where cooking liberates the nutrients and makes them more available. And you use the example of tomatoes, and that's a good example to liberate the lycopene so it can be absorbed. A food with high nutrients that doesn't get absorbed into our body really doesn't do us much good. It just passes on through. Similarly, carrots are the same thing. If you cook carrots, it delivers the carotenes or the carotenoids better than if you were to eat them raw. So here's a place where cooking the right way, which is generally steaming to soften the cell walls of the carrot up, it makes it more available. Now, on the other side of the story, as you were indicating, would be overcooking or high temperature cooking, a food that may be rich in protein and also rich in starch or sugar. In that case, what happens at high temperature flame cooking is that charring that we see that we like on the crust of bread or the charbroil on meat, that is really a consequence of a chemical reaction occurring where the protein and the sugar reacts together under what chemists call the Maillard reaction. That crusty protein, which results, actually, as you mentioned, has the name advanced glycosylation end products. That's a very scientific name. It really means crusty proteins. And those proteins, when we consume them, have been suggested to have an adverse effect on our physiology. They're not actually desirable. They may be serving to cause this inflammation response that I was describing earlier. So the body more be likely to have an insulin dysregulation or to have a problem with inflammatory mediators in joint space. So they wake up in the morning stiff and sore. This is a very interesting concept that's emerging to say it's not just the foods themselves, but it's also the way they're processed that then maybe makes them different in the way they respond to our body.
Now, our body is also very good at breaking things down, but this method of cooking, as I understand it, makes it more difficult for our body to deal with the glycosylated proteins, and they tend to accumulate in body tissues such as the brain or the coronary arteries. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. And I think, again, it's I don't want to take this to extreme. A few charbroiled things here and there are not going to create a serious problem. But if a person were to have the majority of their protein-rich foods charbroiled and they were to be drinking and eating a lot of sugar-rich foods and beverages, those combinations may increase the risk to the injurious effects of these advanced glycosylated end products, which, by the way, the abbreviation is AGE, or age. So many people say you biologically age when you have more aged proteins, right? Because the deleterious effect they have on your systemic physiology.
Well, we've often thought in medicine that diabetes represents a situation of accelerated aging, and we've looked at glycosylated hemoglobin as being one of our markers for how well the blood sugar is doing. But really, glycosylated hemoglobin is more than that. It's a poster child or an example of one of these age advanced glycosylated end products.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I think doctors were aware that the hemoglobin A1C or glycosylated hemoglobin was a useful tool for seeing if their diabetic patients were cheating on their diet, because they couldn't cheat on that number. That number would be elevated if they cleaned up their diet and lifestyle right before they came in the office. It still would show an advanced level of that, elevated level of that particular blood chemical. But now we're starting to recognize that it's more than just a monitoring device to see if a diabetic patient is cheating. What it really tells us is something about how much of these crusty proteins are being formed in the body. It may be not the most sensitive indicator, but it's an easy one clinically to measure. So now doctors are starting to reevaluate the usefulness of that test. rather than just using it to test diabetics, they're using it to follow people that may be on their way to diabetes and have this insulin resistance and hyperinsulinemia or metabolic syndrome.
Dr. Bland, what exactly is metabolic syndrome? We've been talking a lot about diabetes and hypertension and high cholesterol and rolling those all together into a single entity called metabolic syndrome, but really, what is the root disease here, and what do we do about it?
Well, metabolic syndrome is a very interesting term that actually goes back to Dr. H.P. Heimsworth, who was the dean of the London School of Medicine back in the 1930s and 1940s, who was involved with the discovery of insulin and its use in the treatment of diabetes. And what he found is that there were certain type of diabetics that actually did not have a deficiency of the hormone insulin, but they looked diabetic. They actually had a very high level of insulin. So then he said in a paper in 1936 in the medical journal The Lancet, he said, well, hold it. If these people have a high level of insulin, but they look like they're diabetic, meaning they have their blood sugar, glucose is very elevated, there must be something wrong with the way insulin message is being received by their body. They may be insensitive to their message. So he proposed that there must be another form of diabetes that was related to the lack of the understanding of the message of insulin. So your pancreas that secretes insulin was throwing out a bunch of it to try to get the message across, just like what happens when someone doesn't seem to understand you. You raise your voice until they finally, you think, are going to hear you. So insulin goes up and up and up in level as the message is not heard correctly. This has now been called hyperinsulinemia, meaning elevated insulin, and it's associated with a different kind of diabetes than the kind that's generally seen in childhood. It's the kind that we used to call adult onset. Now we call it type 2 diabetes. And 85% of the people that have type 2 diabetes, which is the most common form of diabetes, constitutes over 90% of the cases of diabetes in the United States. 85% of those people that have that type 2 diabetes have normal or high levels of insulin, not low levels of insulin. So this model that we learn in school, most of us somewhere in grade school, that diabetes was associated with low levels of insulin and high levels of blood sugar, and that caused injury to our eyes and our nerves and our kidneys, that model is true for this juvenile onset form, so-called type 1, but it's not true generally for type 2. Type 2 is the more common form, and it's generally associated with elevated insulin. So that's been called metabolic syndrome, and it's associated with insulin resistance. The message of insulin is not getting across, so the pancreas is working harder and harder and harder. It's doing push-ups all the time, trying to keep up with the need to signal to the cells the need to take up sugar from the blood, but it's not getting its message across effectively. And the problem with that condition, that metabolic syndrome, is that high level of insulin, insulin now starts having other effects on the body that it would normally not have when it was at its normal lower level. The higher levels of insulin then stimulate cells to grow more quickly, so it's associated with increased risk to cancer. It stimulates injury to the arterial wall, so it's associated with increased incidence of heart disease. It stimulates problems related to inflammation molecules, so now people's osteoarthritis or degenerative joint disease increases in severity. And they never even knew it was related to insulin. They were being treated for a tennis elbow, and they didn't know that it could have been associated with this insulin problem. And that is, I think, the big new discovery. It's ironic that it took us from 1936 to 2004 to finally pick up on it in medicine, but now it's a very well-recognized phenomenon.
So the fact that, for example, we see a lot of carpal tunnel syndrome in diabetics is related to the effect of the insulin as a pro-inflammatory?
Well, that's one of the effects that it could have. It causes our connective tissue, like the elastin and collagen that make up our tendons and ligaments, to become more tight and less elastic and stretchy. And in so doing, there's more mechanical wear and tear and more inflammation. So people might say, gee whiz, I'm losing the flexibility in my joints and I'm starting to have pain in my wrists. You often see this with people using the computers all the time. They can't seem to stay on their computers, and they're using funny mouse pads and all sorts of things to try to get around this. And this could be aggravated. Obviously, there's repetitive motion problems, but this could be aggravated by these inflammation conditions promoted through the poor control of insulin.
Does insulin act in some sort of direct way to cause high blood pressure?
Yes, and that's a new discovery, actually, that's quite remarkable. Dr. Gerald Reaven, professor emeritus of endocrinology from Stanford Med School, was the first investigator to discover what it called triad of symptoms associated with high insulin levels, this type 2 diabetes. And he said that metabolic syndrome was associated with increased levels of a blood fat called triglycerides, increased levels of blood pressure, and increased levels of kidney injury, and that those particular characteristics were the hallmarks of this metabolic syndrome. As people have studied this more over the last 20 years, just recently, Dr. Paul Ridker, a professor of cardiology at Harvard Med School, authored a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine in which he showed that the metabolic syndrome was very closely related to what we call essential hypertension. I like the term, right? Essential, as if to be a mid-age individual in our society, you have to have elevated blood pressure.
It's essential to have hypertension.
Right? If you're not, you're not fully actualized as a mid-age individual. So what he's finding is that the elevated insulin levels actually cause the artery walls to become much more rigid, less contractible, and less able to dilate, so your blood pressure then, like constricting a pipe, becomes higher.
Is that a genetic effect? Is the insulin getting into the cells of the vascular wall and changing their DNA?
It doesn't actually change the DNA as such, but it changes the expression of the DNA, like we were talking about earlier.
It changes what book gets opened
and read. That's right, exactly.
Or what chapter.
Precisely. And as a consequence, the chapter that was being read normally, which is the chapter of relax the arteries, now becomes the chapter of contract the arteries. And when they contract, then your vascular pressure goes up, and now the patient goes and says, gee, I need to be on blood pressure medication. And unfortunately, the blood pressure medication may be treating the effect and not the cause. And then you have to worry about what are the side effects of the blood pressure medication, rather than maybe treating the cause, which was the insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia.
Well, if high levels of insulin are this toxic, then aren't we as physicians making a rather terrible mistake when we use insulin to treat type 2 diabetes?
Well, that's always a very significant risk in the use of insulin. As you know, as a physician, you get into the relative risk-benefit relationships. In the patient who has no more insulin that their pancreas can produce, then their life will depend upon giving insulin, so you just have to put up with some of the relative risks. In a person, however, who still has marginal insulin secreting ability, to give them more insulin is absolutely the wrong thing to do, because it actually causes the residual amount of insulin secreting ability they have to go away, and now it makes the person dependent on administration of insulin with some of its adverse effects. So this is one of Dr. Reaven's major concerns about how endocrinologically people with diabetes are treated, because we've assumed in the past that if you're diabetic, you need more insulin. And giving more insulin to a person with high insulin only aggravates the problem. It doesn't solve the problem. A physician that I think is keeping up with their art understands that they have to differentiate those patients that are not able to secrete insulin from their pancreas versus those that are, and their insulin is just insensitive, and they'll be treated a different way.
I've seen a phenomenon professionally in the last couple of years that I was taught in medical school never occurred, and that's the phenomenon of people with type 2 diabetes showing up in the emergency room in diabetic ketoacidosis. Now, these are people who, if you look at their insulin level in their bloodstream, they've got a good insulin level. What are they doing with ketoacidosis, which I was trained only occurs in the complete and utter absence of insulin?
Yes, I think there is a classic example. That would be a kind of the emergency room version of what I've been speaking to. That we assume that when we measure something in the blood and it's within normal levels of a reference range, that that must mean it's okay. So how could a person then come into the emergency room looking like they're in diabetic disease crisis when their insulin levels when measured are in the normal range? And what we have to remember is each person responds to their hormones unique to their own physiological state. So normal range are great for determining kind of average effects. But if you're looking at individual effects, and for instance, if that particular patient is highly insensitive to their insulin, they could be diabetic looking even though they had normal insulin levels. And I think that is a part of our transition from treating everybody as the so-called 70-kilogram human being, the average individual that you learn about in medical school throughout your education. Then you go into clinical practice, and you never see that average 70-kilogram person. You
I can don't practice. See any 70-kilogram males at all.
Exactly. Anyway. Yeah, now it's 70 going 80 going 90-kilogram people, and nobody's average. Everybody's unique.
Let's change topics and talk a little bit about C-reactive protein. A few years ago, I began hearing about C-reactive protein, and even a year ago at the Institute of Functional Medicine conference, it was still not entirely clear whether C-reactive protein was, like hemoglobin A1c, merely a marker for the inflammatory state, or whether it was itself a bad actor, an injurious compound. Now, this year I'm hearing that, no, it looks like C-reactive protein is, in fact, a negative thing to have in your body in the first place, and that altering C-reactive protein has a beneficial effect.
Yes, I think there is still a very significant amount of information that we want to gain about C-reactive protein, but certainly in the last year, numbers of studies have been published implicating it more strongly as a very important marker for inflammation-related injuries that could be associated with diabetes or heart disease or stroke or hypertension risk or even cancer risk. The question that really is being raised by experts in the field in this area of inflammation is whether C-reactive protein is a primary or a secondary marker for inflammation. And here's where the story gets a little bit more confusing, because now as consumers read articles on C-reactive protein, they're jumping to their doctor saying, please do my C-reactive protein analysis because I've heard this is important for me to know. It is important to know, but it's not the be-all and end-all. That's what the story is really emerging to be understood. C-reactive protein is really a secondary inflammatory substance in the blood that's produced in the liver as a consequence of messages that it gets from other reactive inflammation substances. And these substances may not always trigger C-reactive protein. They may trigger other things in the body that are not necessarily measured when you're measuring C-reactive protein. So it would be possible, and in fact, not only possible, we've seen it clinically in their studies showing this, that you could have a low normal level of C-reactive protein but still have inflammation. It's also possible that you could have an elevated C-reactive protein, but that was indicative of the fact that you just had a cold or you had a flu or you had a tennis injury or something that was creating a short-term inflammation that wasn't a long-term problem that was related to heart disease or cancer or diabetes. So I would caution people about putting all their eggs in the C-reactive protein basket. It's a good marker, but it is not singularly definitive of the risk that were associated with inflammation and heart disease or diabetes.
Another concept that I'm not previously familiar with before I started attending these conferences was this concept of organ reserve and how it relates to aging. Could you amplify on that a little bit for us?
Yes, I think there was a seminal paper published, and it's actually one of the founding papers from which the Institute for Functional Medicine was born. It was authored by Dr. James Fries. He had this article published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1980, and it was talking about aging, compression of morbidity, and natural death. And he was proposing that people die prematurely before their time that would be locked in their genes, knowing that each of us has some kind of a mortality somewhere in our genes. The question could be, is it 100 years or 120 years? I don't think we've fully defined that, but certainly it's more than 74 years for most people, or 75 years. And so his question was, how do you live out to the limit of your biologically potential life expectancy? And so doing, how do you maintain your health to the limit of your life expectancy so that you compress morbidity or sickness into the last few moments of your life? You don't spend the last years in and out of hospitals and in convalescent care centers and disabled and requiring heroic intervention. So he was asking the question about, in animals, how is it that animals can live up right to the limit of their biologically determined lifespan, and then they just kind of die? I don't know if you've ever had domestic animals, but that can, you know, often happen, that your cat or dog may seem really healthy and frisky but the last few weeks or maybe months of their life, and then they quickly become disabled and die. And humans are normally not like that. They start kind of falling apart at a younger age. So he was asking the question, he said, and the reason for it in animal studies that have been done that they can maintain their function is that they don't lose their organ reserve. Every one of our organs has a capacity to function above that of being at rest, some 5 to 7-fold above what's required just to maintain rest. So that's your reserve. So if you get chased by a saber-toothed tiger, you've got an ability to mobilize your reserve out of your heart and your lungs and hopefully run away before you're eaten. And that was evolutionarily built into our system. In our liver function, cardiovascular function, neurological function, all of our body parts have that reserve. But as we grow older, every animal, humans included, tends to lose their organ reserve. So there's this declination or this decline in organ reserve. So at some age, the same threat by a saber-toothed tiger that you could have run away from at a younger age, now trying to run away, you don't have the reserve to mobilize. It creates a crisis because you've depleted your reserve and you have an event. So in that case, the concept of maintaining good health, what I call your health span, extending your health span, and living out to the full limits of your life potential, is to maintain your organ reserve for as long as possible. And Dr. Fries, in this landmark paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, goes on to use animals as an example. He says, let's take the example of a wild animal versus a domestic animal. So we look at an animal in the zoo. So we take a zebra from Africa, and we know what the mean average life expectancy of a zebra is, or its lifespan, if it didn't get eaten by a lion, what its lifespan would be. Then we take that same animal, we don't change its genes, and we put it in a zoo, and we find out under the suboptimal environment of a zoo, now only lives 3/4 as long. We didn't change its genes, but we lost its organ reserve more quickly. Now, zoo veterinarians, large animal veterinarians, are very sensitive about this because these animals are expensive and they don't want their zoo animals dying. So they try to optimize the environment. Of course, they can do things that we can't do to our patients because they can control the diet and the environment very carefully in a zoo. So now we have a different kind of way animals are quartered in zoos. Now they can roam around and they're fed different diets and they actually live longer than they used to in early zoos. But we as humans are in a different zoo, aren't we? We're exposed to fast foods, we're exposed to cigarettes, we're exposed to excess alcohol, we're exposed to sedentary lifestyles. So our zoo experience lowers our organ reserve and produces increasing risk of disease at early age. So the best medicine, obviously, is to maintain organ reserve. Whatever is required to do that by taking care of yourself, and I call it practicing good health. It's interesting, we don't think about having to practice good health. We would practice tennis or computer programming or the piano or recitation, but who needs to practice good health? That's been given to us as a right. Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, and good health. But if you don't practice something, you're not good at it. And so, you know, it's the old use it or lose it phenomenon.
Use it or lose it. Yeah, indeed. Another concept that was new to me is this idea that fat cells or body fat is actually a very dynamic, interactive signaling organ and not just a storage depot for extra calories.
That is a remarkable discovery. You know, often people say, gee, nothing is happening and we're not making advances in our knowledge. We're kind of running in place. But then if we really look at these kinds of new paradigms that come up, we see we are making some progress. And that's one of the major discoveries that I think has occurred in physiology that will have significant impact on improving this epidemic we have of obesity. And what you pointed out is very, very insightful, that body fat, which all the years of physiology, certainly the 30 years I've been in the field and well before that, was thought of as being a depot storage tissue for extra calories. It was like a bank account. You basically took extra calories from foods that were beyond your ability to use them, and you stored them for a rainy day. And for most of us, the rainy day never came. It just stayed in the bank account. We gained weight year after year. And this was kind of like wearing a saddlebag. The fat really didn't do anything. It just kind of weighted us down. And it actually took about 3 miles of blood capillaries to feed each pound of stored fat. So it was weighting a lot on our heart and our vasculature. So it was almost like carrying dead tissue around for us. And that was the basic concept. That has remarkably changed in the last 5 years. We still recognize that body fat is a depot storage tissue and will accumulate extra calories in the form of fat. But now it's seen that the body fat is a very, very active participant in the secretion of messenger molecules or hormones that trigger to the rest of the body all sorts of information that really sets a tone for the whole other part of the body how to function. These are called adipokines, and the reason they're called that is that the fat cell is called an adipocyte cell. So the adipocyte or fat cell secretes these special hormones called adipokines. These adipokines are unique molecules because they, in the main, have inflammatory potential. So the body can become inflamed from its own body fat, which sounds very, very strange. But if you talk to a person who has had a difficulty with their weight, they'll often complain clinically of sore joints and feeling stiff when they wake up in the morning, and headaches and low back pain. And yes, in part, that's a consequence of the weight they're carrying and the strain on their joints, but it's also a consequence of the release of the fat of these inflammatory substances that promote some of the problems. Now, as we said earlier in this discussion, when inflammation is present, that also can cause injury to the artery wall. When that occurs, it can increase the risk to heart disease. So here is where people are now feeling the origin of heart disease and body fat may emerge. That people always said, well, we know that if you're really obese, that will increase your risk of heart disease, but we don't really know how that occurs. We just know it's associated. Now the mechanism is emerging to be that the body fat is producing these inflammatory substances kind of as a pushback, telling the body, no more, this is enough, I don't want this, I don't like it. But the arteries then pick up this message saying, ouch, and they get injured, and that can increase the risk of heart disease. So what we commonly do, I think, in societies, we say, well, that message of pain is something I don't like, so I'm going to take a pain uncoupling medication, rather than looking at why the pain was there as a warning sign for something that could be much more serious. So the taking of an anti-inflammatory drug may not, in its effect, really treat the problem that was the result of the pain.
So the metaphor might be that the adipocytes, or the fat cells, release these compounds as a signaling attempt to try to change behavior or to try to change the expression of DNA in a way that would compensate. But as a sort of inadvertent side effect, it's like they're releasing acid into the bloodstream and it's burning inside of the coronary arteries. And then as the coronary arteries try to heal, they become damaged and inflamed, and that sets you up for the development of plaque.
Exactly. That's a beautiful way of describing it. You know, you might ask the question, why would the body do this? It sounds like it's creating suicide, and that's a silly thing to do. But actually, every one of these mechanisms that we're talking about has an evolutionary advantage if the major threat to our survival is starvation, which it has been throughout most of human history. All these messenger molecules that I'm describing, they're associated with body fat, were really there at a level to produce a favorable effect in terms of immune defense and in terms of body repair in people whose major concern was not getting enough calories. But now that we have luxurious calories and maybe even the wrong kind of calories from processed foods, now what used to be an advantageous message is turned into a disadvantage to us and becomes our own suicide molecule.
I'd like to ask you about, let's see if I can say this right, 5-methyltetrahydrofolate reductase, an enzyme that, as I'm beginning to understand it, is not present in a certain subset of our population, and that can be very dangerous for them with respect to heart disease. What percentage of people carries this? Let's see, they're called a single nucleotide polymorphism.
Oh, boy, there are a lot of good words there, boy.
Yeah. But basically, it's just like sickle cell disease. You have one amino acid that comes out differently in a protein, and it completely changes the way that protein functions.
Exactly right. And let me, if I can, try to make this story as simple as possible. Folic acid is emerging as one of the B vitamins to be a lot more important than we ever previously thought. And virtually every textbook in nutrition and medicine is now telling an incomplete story about the folate component of health because it's so rapidly advancing. Every month, just all sorts of new papers are coming out. It's a hot area of discovery. And what it has been found within the last 10 years is that people process folate in their body differently based on their genetic uniqueness. So we just can't say that because there is an RDA for folate that all people will be covered adequately by that level. And certain people have a genetic uniqueness of this enzyme that you described, abbreviated MTHFR, methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, which is an enzyme that's responsible for metabolizing folic acid into its active form. And its active form, which is present in every cell of our body, is called 5-methyltetrahydrofolate. So you can eat a lot of folic acid in your diet or by supplements and not get the adequate level into your cells that does the work unless that enzyme can do its work. And if you have the genetically unique form of the enzyme, you can't convert your dietary folate as effectively into the active form of folate in your cells. It's like you have a small pipe and you can't get them through adequately. So in that case, there's only really two things you can do to improve the functional ability of folate physiology. one of which is to either give very higher doses of folic acid. Generally, that would have to come as a supplement because you probably couldn't get this level even with a well-balanced diet that was rich in dark green leafy vegetables that are high in folic acid or folates. So you'd have to supplement, and the level of supplementation would be much higher than the RDI for folic acid rather than the 280 micrograms. It's probably more 1,000 to maybe as much as 3,000 micrograms a day, so much higher level. Or you can go on the other side of where that metabolic uniqueness occurs at the enzyme and give 5-methyltetrahydrofolate, which would be the product of that folic acid step, and that is also available, and you could use a lower level of that as a supplement to try to get around where that small pipe is. And what this does in people that have that genetic characteristic is it lowers the level of a dangerous substance in their blood called homocysteine. And homocysteine, if elevated, can injure their arteries again, can injure their brains, can injure their immune system, and is associated with arthritis. So it's an inflammatory producing molecule, this homocysteine molecule. Now, the question would be, well, how many people really have this? I mean, gee whiz, it sounds very important and serious, but if one in 100,000 people have it, then maybe they ought to be sent off to a metabolic discovery unit, and it's not a generally concerned public health problem. But it turns out through the evaluation of this particular genetic uniqueness, it's much more prevalent than it was thought. About 1 in 5 people carry what's called the heterozygous form of this uniqueness, and about 1 in 10 to 1 in 8 carry the homozygous form. The homozygous is where you got it both from your mother and your father. You can't escape it. It's so-called double allele. And therefore, in those cases, it's a more serious expression into your physiology. And so the question, of course, is, well, gee, if it's only 1 in 10, maybe I'm 1 of the 9 in 10, I don't need to worry about it. But the difficulty is we don't know who the 1 in 10 are, because in medical evaluation and diagnosis or in screening, we don't screen for this particular characteristic. Now, just to show you how this has some very profound implications beyond heart disease and Alzheimer's disease and arthritis, there's another very interesting part of the story that's emerged, which I consider maybe the most socially important. And this relates to problems that are seen in the infant pertaining to leukemia. Leukemia, which is a tragic condition, obviously, has been raised as a problem of its origin. How did this occur when this child, maybe less than a year old or in the first few years of life, ends up with this blood cancer? It just seems like it's a cruel thing of fate, and how did it happen? The parents don't have leukemia. You can't say it's necessarily a cancer gene, so what is occurring? Well, what is emerging to be recognized now is that in the first developmental phase of the fetus after fertilization, that first trimester, there is a tremendous amount of development that's going on in the nervous system and other organs of that fetus, which are requiring a process called methylation. That's what the biochemist or the physiologist would call it. That process is dependent upon 5-methyltetrahydrofolate, the very form of folic acid I was describing. If the mother cannot deliver through the placenta adequate levels of 5-methyltetrahydrofolate during those critical periods of development, then the genes don't get the proper message from that folic acid, and they can express untoward stories. And those untoward stories can be the stories of cell replication that we call leukemia. And so a mother that was undernourished relative to her folic acid status, who carried this genetic uniqueness, MTHFR, making her more at risk, may be then more likely to give rise to the offspring that has leukemia. For a few pennies a day, therefore, of increased folic acid intake, she may have prevented a very serious problem seen in her infant. Never knowing that, because her blood chemistry looked fine, she didn't look like she had anemia, but the infant that's requiring all this methylation from folic acid derivatives was just not getting the proper amount of information. Now, I want to emphasize what I'm saying has been documented now, not just in one or two studies, but numerous studies. This is a very active area of investigation. And it turns out that this story goes on even a little farther, because in children that are treated with various types of chemotherapeutic drugs that would maybe manage their juvenile cancer, their pediatric cancers, many times these are drugs like methotrexate or 5-fluorouracil. These are antifolate drugs. They actually work by blocking folic acid. So now let's say that infant was born from this problem of undermethylation, and they now are treated for their cancer with an antifolate, and they inherited from their parents this problem of low folic acid metabolism. Now what that produces in them is seizure disorders, because the brain requires proper levels of folic acid as 5-methyltetrahydrofolate to work. And so if you go to a pediatric oncology unit in a hospital, you'll find that one of the side effects they have in these children are seizures. And so they then treat them with anti-seizure medications. The anti-seizure medications are really treating the symptoms of a folate deficiency in the nervous system. So this is a very complex story that's emerging that I believe is going to both help us to prevent leukemias that are preventable and to manage better children or adults who have these folate uniquenesses.
A follow-up on that then. I've seen in some of the labs who are here at the conference a test for methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase. Is that the appropriate way that we should be screening? Is a serum homocysteine level adequate? What sort of steps should I as a clinician be taking to identify this common disorder in my clients?
Well, I think homocysteine is probably the most practical at this time because almost every medical laboratory can offer a homocysteine rather than the gene test, which is more in a few laboratories available at this time. The homocysteine is a pretty good screening test, and it's unfortunate that right now, based upon, quote, wisdom within the powers that be of medical reimbursement, that they consider the measurement of homocysteine to be overutilization. It's a medical service that's not essential. So many insurance providers don't cover for a homocysteine, or Medicare doesn't cover for a homocysteine. I consider this to be really short-sighted, because by understanding this and modifying it early on, you may prevent a very serious expensive problem like Alzheimer's disease, or like coronary artery disease and a heart attack and a bypass surgery. That's a lot more expense and a lot more dehumanization of the individual than a few pennies a day of folate and a test that may cost $100.
One final question on the subject of folate. Epidemiologically, there's a strong association between hyperlipidemia and depression. I've heard that this type of folate, the 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate, is very important in the brain as well. Is that the missing link between depression and high cholesterol?
Well, it may have an interesting relationship, and this is a new part of the story that's emerging. In Europe, for the past decade, a prescription drug to treat depression is a drug that is made up of a chemical called S-adenosylmethionine, which is abbreviated as SAM or SAM.
SAM-E.
Right, SAM-E. And that particular compound is produced in the nervous system as a consequence of the metabolism of 5-methyltetrahydrofolate through homocysteine to produce S-adenosylmethionine, or SAM-E. So you see studies in the medical and psychiatric literature that have shown that you can produce the same treatment of depression by giving higher doses of 5-methyltetrahydrofolate. Rather than giving SAM-E, or giving one step before that to try to promote the brain to produce this desirable chemical. Now, why does that lower depression? Because SAM-E is a substance used in the nervous system to make neurotransmitters that are involved with mood, the serotonergic and dopaminergic transmitters. So if you have a SAM-E deficiency, which could come from a 5-methyltetrahydrofolate deficiency, then you may have dysphoria or mood-related problems because your neurotransmitters are imbalanced. So the brain connects to the heart, connects to the joints, connects to the oncological risk to the breast and the uterus and the ovaries and the prostate and to leukemia in children.
So you can't treat one organ system without affecting all of the others.
That's the functional medicine story, and that's what we're trying so hard to get across to doctors and ultimately to their patients, that we have made it simple in medicine through this concept of the disease. Assuming that each disease was independent and isolated and it could be treated separate from anything else in the body. So if a patient comes in and they have a headache and they got a snuffy nose and they got a sore wrist and they got digestive problems and they've got a rash on their skin, each of those are treated as different singular entities with different medications. So the person may end up with 5 or 6 medications. From the functional medicine model, we would ask the questions, is there a root origin for all of those? Is there some imbalance in the body that is really the cause that expresses itself into all these 5 conditions, so that the treatment is not 5 drugs, the treatment is one treatment that then produces 5 responses. And that is, I think, treating the mechanism of disorders, not just the disease. And that's where medicine is going.
Dr. Bland, thank you so much for sharing your insights with my audience.
It's really been my privilege. Thanks so much.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Dr. Jeffrey Bland. I have a couple of news stories here for you to while away the last few minutes of the program. It was a good week for pediatric news. So let's start with a study talking about older kids, middle schoolers. This research was published online in the journal Education. If you want to read the original work, search Ronald Ziegler, Ziegler, the study's co-author, and you'll be able to find it online. This research looked at 189 middle schoolers in the California public school system who were below proficiency level in English and math. It was a controlled study, and the students were taught to practice transcendental meditation. Transcendental meditation, interestingly enough, worked best in the students with the lowest levels of academic performance, who showed a significant improvement in overall achievement compared to controls. 41% overall of the meditating students showed at least one performance level in math compared to 15% of controls. There were also less objective measurements on the part of the faculty that indicated improvement in hyperactivity, less student fights, less abusive language, and a more relaxed and calm atmosphere. Obviously, things difficult to score objectively and subject to observer bias, but nevertheless, I think an easy and cheap, and I might add, completely safe intervention would be to teach your child to meditate. And what an idea. The family that meditates together, well, let's make that a contest. Send me your suggestions for finishing off that little ditty. And on to the next story. Babies who start solid food before the age of 4 months have a sixth-fold increase in their risk of obesity by the time they're age 3. Now, correlation does not equal causation, and I'm sure there's other behavioral issues in those homes. But nevertheless, this effect was very, very strong when children had never breastfed or were weaned before the age of 4 months. Interestingly enough, breastfeeding was highly protective against obesity, even in children who were fed solids before the age of 4 months. Well, that's all we have for today. And this is Dr. Dawn saying I'll be back next week with lots of information about emerging and also long-term chronic infectious disease. Until then, so long and stay healthy.